Today at Reader's Corner, Matthew Algio, author of The President is a Sick Man, wherein the supposedly virtuous Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth.
I've always been fascinated by Grover Cleveland. He ran for re-election, lost, came back 4 years later, and won the White House back. This was a really interesting time in American surgery, and really antiseptic surgical practices were only beginning to be accepted in the United States. E.J. Edwards was really one of the first investigative reporters in American history. Really, at the time, journalism is just kind of moving out of its really partisan phase into objective journalism.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On July 1st, 1893, in the midst of a nationwide economic panic, President Grover Cleveland boarded a friend's yacht on Long Island and vanished for 5 days. During that time, a team of skilled doctors removed a cancerous tumor from the president's palate along with much of his upper jaw. When an enterprising and widely respected reporter named E.J. Edwards exposed the clandestine operation, Cleveland denied it. Because the president was well known for his unyielding honesty, many Americans simply would not believe the story, and Edwards was consequently vilified in the popular press. It would take 24 years before the truth was finally revealed. This incredible story is told by Matthew Algio in his new book, The President is a Sick Man. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Algio. Mr. Algio has reported from three continents for public radio's All Things Considered, Marketplace, and Morning Edition. The President is a Sick Man is not his first foray into reporting about unusual and interesting facts in American history. He also is the author of Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, about the former president's cross-country road trip after he left the White House. Mr. Algio was a guest on Reader's Corner in 2010 to discuss Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, and we're pleased to welcome him back, featuring him on our program today to talk about his latest book. Mr. Algio joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. Matthew Algio, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Well, first, I must tell you that I had great response from readers who heard our interview on your book, Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure. And I don't know whether I've ever had so many people say they went out and got a copy of it because they just found it so interesting. And now along comes this book on Grover Cleveland. As I was finishing the book, I thought, you know, where was Matthew when I was taking American history? I was falling asleep in these lectures, and I was reading these dry and sometimes boring textbooks. And boy, if I was teaching 19th century American history, I'd take your book and I'd make them read it the first day of class, and then you could weave throughout it the whole rest of the course. Have you ever had anybody tell you that the book came in handy in the classroom?
Well, I take that as a huge compliment, actually. I mean, I try. I'm not a fancy writer by any means, and as you mentioned, my background is in radio, so I tend to write pretty simply, and I don't get too bogged down in fancy 50-cent words. I actually recently found out that an excerpt from Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure is going to be used on a standardized test for a high school student. So maybe somebody at least, I guess, thought it was worthwhile in terms of teaching something.
Absolutely. Well, the other interesting thing about this book in particular, I think it probably also applies to the Truman book, but you wind up throwing in so many interesting little slices of American history long forgotten that may not have been all that important to anybody then, but when you look back on it now, for example, I had no idea that at one point in our history, we had a 21-year-old first lady in the White House.
You know? That's right. I don't think we're going to see another 21-year-old first lady again, but you never know. It could happen. Well, one of the cool things about researching this book for me is that I had a big gap in my knowledge of American history. I kind of know the Civil War, and I kind of know, you know, World War One and, you know, World War Two, but that time between the Civil War and the First World War, I really didn't know much about, and that was one of the things that got me interested in the story in the first place. It was a good chance for me to learn a lot more about American history in the Gilded Age. And it was really fun to do because when you look back, there are so many things that are parallel what's going on today. You know, in 1893, there was a big financial panic, as you mentioned, and really it was precipitated by a speculative bubble. And in 1893, the bubble was railroads. Well, of course, more recently, we've had our own bubbles in real estate and dot-coms. And so it was a lot of fun to go back and look at the 1880s and 1890s and find these things out and to find so much that still resonates even today.
So place Grover Cleveland, if you will, Matthew, in this era, his politics, his career in government, what is he doing in the 80s, in the 90s? He is also the only president to serve two non-consecutive terms in office. Is that right?
Yeah, of course, Grover's the one that screws up the numbering because he's president's number 22 and 24. And I always like to point out, I was at a little party watching the inauguration of Barack Obama, and his inaugural address, he said, 44 people have now taken this oath of office. And I jumped up and said, only 43. Grover counts twice, but nobody wants to hear that. Grover, one of the things, too, that really got me, I've always been fascinated by Grover Cleveland. I mean, just the fact that he ran for re-election, lost, came back 4 years later, and won the White House back is a unique achievement in American politics. So he must have been an amazing politician. So it was a lot of fun to research Grover. You know, in 1880, nobody ever heard of Grover Cleveland. In 1881, he gets elected mayor of Buffalo. In 1882, he gets elected governor of New York. In 1884, he gets elected president of the United States. So this guy came out of nowhere. I mean, really, it's hard to imagine somebody coming from, you know, more obscurity to the presidency in a faster time than Grover Cleveland, which is just another sign that he was just this amazing politician.
Well, and you know, if you stop and think of Barack Obama's career, people were saying that he moved so fast. But my gosh, he was moving at a snail's pace compared to this guy.
There was a lot of interesting parallels, like I said before, with today. And yeah, a lot of the things that people are saying about Barack Obama, you know, what is his background? What does he really believe? Where did he come from? People said these things about Grover Cleveland when he was elected president. You know, Grover Cleveland didn't step foot in Washington until the day before his inauguration. I mean, he was the ultimate outsider. It's just amazing. And there was another interesting thing that as I was researching the book that I found that there was a birther controversy. I don't go into it in the book too much, but Chester Arthur, who was elected vice president in 1880, there were rumors that he was born in Quebec, and so he would not have been eligible to be president. And so all kinds of things keep popping up in my research that you know, make me think, wow, things have not changed a lot.
Well, tell us about the 84 campaign, his first attempt to run. In that campaign, there was some very serious mudslinging regarding this incident of the illegitimate child. And when I read that, I thought, wow, you know, that makes Bill Clinton look like he's pure as the driven snow.
Again, the similarities are striking. If you think politics are dirty today, and you need to go back and look at the 1880s and 1890s because those were some vicious elections. But late in the 1884 campaign, it came out that Grover Cleveland had fathered an illegitimate child. And, you know, to us today, a politician fathering an illegitimate child is something so preposterous it would never happen, right? But actually it happened back in 1884, and Grover owned up to it. I mean, that was the really amazing thing. He sent a telegram to his friends back in Buffalo, and it just said simply, tell the truth. And really, by owning up to this indiscretion, he gained more than he lost. People really respected his honesty and his forthrightness in this situation. And this is really where you see his reputation as the honest president begin. He was known for his integrity, and eventually his nickname would be the Honest President.
And we're still not completely sure whether that was his child or maybe the child of somebody he was trying to protect.
Exactly. Grover admitted that he was caring for the child, that he provided for the child. He never explicitly acknowledged paternity. And, of course, back then there was no way to do any sort of DNA test or anything. And so we really don't know to this day if that child was actually Grover's offspring. Although if the child has descendants, we could easily answer that question with a DNA test today. So it's really one of those intriguing presidential questions.
Mm-hmm. So he lost his re-election campaign in 1888, but he won the popular vote and lost the electoral vote. What was going on there?
Again, you know, one of those things, oh, we'll never see that again. And, of course, we've seen it quite recently. Grover won the popular vote in three straight elections, 84, 88, and 92. Really what it came down to was New York State. New York was the most populous state at that time and had the most electoral votes. And it came down to, really, in all three elections, whoever won New York State would win the election. And Grover carried New York State in 1884, but he lost it in 1888, and so Benjamin Harrison won the election. There's a funny story to Frances Cleveland, his young wife, First Lady, as she was leaving the White House when they lost to Harrison, that she told the chief steward at the White House, "Now, don't change anything. We'll be back in 4 years."
Now, you mentioned his young wife, and I've alluded to it before, but he was 49 when he married 21-year-old Frances. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
It was kind of an odd relationship, and just not because of the age difference. Frances Folsom, which was her maiden name, she was actually the daughter of one of Grover's old law partners, and the law partner had died in a carriage accident when Frances was quite young, just 3 or 4, I believe. And so Grover had really kind of served as Frances's guardian growing up, and when she went off to college, they began corresponding, and as I say in the book, it blossomed into something else. And you're right, Frances was 21. Grover was 49 when they were married in the White House in 1886, the only president actually to be married in the White House itself. And she turned out to be a huge political asset for Grover. Grover was kind of taciturn. I mean, he took things very seriously, but Frances was like a breath of fresh air when she moved into the White House, and really one of the most beloved first ladies in American history.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems to me from reading the book that there are two things you have to know before you can begin to understand why Grover Cleveland would go to such lengths to keep his cancer surgery secret and to go out to sea to have these surgeons perform it. And one is the story of Grant and how he died. And the second is, you mentioned it already, the panic of 1893 that's going on, where the country is coming unglued and they need a strong president. They need somebody at the helm. Tell us how both of those then lead us into what Grover Cleveland decides to do when it comes to the surgery. And we'll talk about the surgery, of course.
Yeah, what happened was it was in June of 1893, just a few months after Grover took office, that he noticed a little bump on the roof of his mouth. And his doctor diagnosed it as cancer. And as you mentioned, Ulysses Grant had actually an oral cancer, not very different than Grover's. This was about 10 years before, and Grant's death was a real spectacle. I mean, it was kind of a morbid death watch that went on outside his townhouse in New York. And at the time, too, there was kind of a stigma attached to cancer. I mean, they didn't even use the word in the newspaper. They'd call it the dread disease, or the disease that no doctor dare name. And Grover had no... He had no desire to become the object of a spectacle like Grant was. And so that was one of the reasons he wanted to keep things secret. And the other, as you mentioned, was the panic of 1893. As I said, there was the speculative bubble, railroads. The Reading Railroad had gone bankrupt about 9 days before Grover took office. And by the end of 1893, 119 railroads would go bankrupt. Wall Street was crashing. And Grover feared that if it came to be known he had cancer, which at the time was really considered a death sentence, that Wall Street would utterly collapse, and the markets would collapse, and the panic would only get worse. And so those were the two main reasons that he decided to have the operation in secret.
And I understand that Grover put away about 20 cigars a day. That's hard to believe that a guy could smoke 20 cigars a day, and as I remember it, the cancer was on the same side that he chewed the cigar.
Yeah, he liked to chew cigars especially, and it was noted that the cancer was on the cigar-chewing side. Grover was not our healthiest president by any means. I think he was approaching 300 pounds by the time he was president, and he liked to smoke. He liked to drink. His favorite food was German food. He was from Buffalo, and he loved German food, bratwurst and sauerkraut and those kinds of things. And so he didn't have the healthiest habits in the world, and these might have been contributing factors to the cancer.
You're listening to Matthew Algio. He is the author of The President is a Sick Man, and it has the longest subtitle. You'll find it somewhere in the Book of Records. But in any event, tell us about that subtitle.
The subtitle, you know, we're trying to be have a little fun with the wordy Gilded Age subtitles, you know, where they'd say, being the true and fair account of
right.
blah, blah, blah. And actually, the original subtitle that we had suggested was even longer. But we found out that modern book-selling databases have a limit on the number of characters you can have in your subtitle. we actually had to cut it down as a concession to the modern age.
Well, let's get back to the surgery. So Grover has this really serious problem in his mouth, and he has to get it taken care of. Set up how this all happens on a yacht in Long Island Sound or wherever it was.
Yeah, if you're president and you need to have a serious operation and you want to do it in secret, your options are pretty limited. The White House was out. Grover had a summer home in Massachusetts, but again, a lot of reporters around. Hospitals at the time weren't really the best option for having serious surgery. Most people who could afford it would have the care done at home. It was Grover who came up with the idea of doing the operation on a friend's yacht. He had a friend who owned a yacht, and they often went fishing together. And so the cover story would be, hey, I'm just going to go fishing for a few days with my friend on his yacht. And they secretly assembled a team of doctors, six doctors, and these were really the cream of the crop of American surgery. One of the guys was a guy named Keene from Philadelphia, and he had performed the first successful removal of a brain tumor in the United States. And so what they did is they gathered all the doctors on the night of June 30th. They secretly ferried them to the boat from different places, and then they gathered in New York on the 30th, and then on the afternoon of the 1st, they set sail for Long Island Sound. And they did the operation on the boat.
Now, one of the things that I was fascinated to learn, and I guess I should have figured this out, but it's amazing how little doctors knew about the issue of infection and the role germs play in complicating surgeries and in so many deaths. And I think you talk a little bit about that in your book.
Yeah, this was a really interesting time in American surgery. It was almost between the medieval and modern surgery, and really antiseptic surgical practices were only beginning to be accepted in the United States. You know, well into the 20th century, a lot of doctors didn't accept the germ theory of disease. They just couldn't understand how these invisible germs could cause infections. And Cleveland was lucky that his doctors were really state-of-the-art for their time, and although they performed the operation on a boat, they were very clean to very, very careful to sanitize the operating theater such as it was. It was really just a little room below deck, but they disinfected it, and of course they disinfected the instruments as well. And so he really was lucky that he had kind of, like I said, the cream of the crop of American surgeons.
And his options for anesthesia were not exactly great either. I mean, in those days, ether was around, and you explain how there were two choices, and one of them was really bad for Grover, either because of his weight or his health or something.
Right. They had hoped to do the operation using nitrous oxide or laughing gas, but that doesn't put you under very deeply. And so they tried that, and it wasn't enough to anesthetize Grover. And so what they ended up having to use was ether. A couple problems with ether. One, it's very combustible. And they were operating, of course, in this small room below deck on a boat. And the other problem is it can aggravate kidney problems. It can also cause pneumonia, and it can trigger a stroke as well. And, of course, Grover was so heavy, he was a prime candidate for a stroke. So it was very risky. Just the anesthesia itself in this operation was very risky.
You have to wonder what the odds were that the ship wasn't going to be moving from side to side, and were they going to be able to do this surgery at all? Apparently, it must have been a very calm day.
It was a very calm day. I went back and looked at the weather records. They were very lucky. I think the plan was, what they did is when they left New York, they sailed up to Grover's home on Buzzards Bay in Massachusetts. And I think the plan was, as soon as they had a chance to operate, as soon as they found the calmest weather or the calmest place, that's when they would do the operation. And as it turned out, it was only a few hours after they left New York when they got onto Long Island Sound, and the sound was just as smooth as glass that day, and the boat moved very slowly, and so that's why they were able to accomplish the operation. That's why they underwent the operation, performed the operation at that time. If they had anchored, then you have the movement of the waves, and that might be worse. So I think they decided that it would be safer to move very slowly and steadily, and that way they could have a fairly stable atmosphere.
And as I remember it, you referred to the team of doctors who did this. One, at least one, was a dentist. And Wasn't that the guy that actually may have been the leak on this? I mean, because obviously it gets out, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But tell us how you think that all came unhinged.
Well, what happened was one of the doctors was a dentist named Hasbrook. At the time, dentists were the most experienced anesthetists, and Hasbrouck was probably the most experienced in the country at that time. Problem was, he had an appointment the next day, July 2nd, and he missed that appointment because he was stuck on the boat with the other doctors after the operation on July 1st. So when he showed up late for the appointment the next day, he had an appointment with another doctor to administer anesthesia. He explained his absence by saying, well, I was operating on President Cleveland. And this is when the word first started to filter out. At first, just among the doctors, really, among doctors in New York, whispers went around that this operation had occurred and that Cleveland had cancer and that they had had to remove part of his jaw. But you're right, that's the first whispers of what really happened on the boat.
Well, let's bring E.J. Edwards into this story. This is the reporter that's trying to do his job as a reporter, and he stumbles across this. How, and also tell us a little bit about him and his craft in those days.
E.J. Edwards was really one of the first great investigative journalists in American history. And it was at a time when newspapers were changing from the really partisan press that we saw really in the Civil War. And they're switching over to what we consider modern journalism, more of a objective journalism. And Edwards worked with some amazing people. He worked with Jacob Riis on How the Other Half Live. He was an early patron of Stephen Crane. And he really deserves to be better remembered, if only for this scoop. It turned out that Edwards knew a doctor in New York, and this doctor had heard the rumors about Grover Cleveland's health. And that was the connection that led Edwards to discover the true story of what had happened to Grover Cleveland.
Part of this is about the newspapers themselves. I mean, they were so competitive. They tore each other up. And in this particular case, one's trying to tear the other one down. Is that the Philadelphia paper that E.J. was with?
Yeah, he was with the Press. And it was known as a Republican paper. And what happened was, when Edwards reported the story in late August of 1893 that Cleveland had had this operation, the Cleveland administration denied it outright. They said that it was only a bad case of dentistry, and dentistry was the cover story. Of course, this wasn't true, and Edwards reported the operation, but Cleveland continued to deny it. And as I was saying earlier, Cleveland had this reputation for honesty that was relatively unimpeachable, and so the public and the press tended to believe Cleveland's version of events. And what happened was the Democratic papers just attacked Edwards. I mean, it was just vicious. They called him a panic monger, a disgrace to journalism, a cancer faker, all sorts of things like that. And so they really tore down Edwards. And as a result, he was thoroughly discredited.
It sounds like Grover Cleveland was also pretty lucky in a most unfortunate way. There were a couple of natural disasters that threw this off the front page.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, at the time of the operation, Frances was pregnant with their second child, and it was only a few weeks after the story broke about the operation that she had the child, and so this sort of seemed to prove to the public that Cleveland was well. Also, there was a huge hurricane that hit the southeast, one of the worst hurricanes in American history, really just the day after the story broke. And this really swept the stories about Cleveland's health off the front pages. And so there was some fortunate timing on Grover's part that the story really got buried.
So we have Grover Cleveland recovering, going back to live another 15 years after the operation. In the meantime, this mass that they removed from his jaw, his upper mouth is taken somewhere where it sits for an awfully long time until eventually it's diagnosed.
What happened was in 1917, now we're 24 years after the operation, and Grover's been dead about 10 years. One of the doctors who had taken part in the operation, Keene from Philadelphia, who I mentioned earlier, he'd always felt badly about the way Edwards had been treated in the press. And so he decided that he would finally write an account of the operation. He got permission from Cleveland's widow, Frances, and he published an account in the Saturday Evening Post in September of 1917. And Keene did this, he said, to vindicate Edwards' reputation as a truthful correspondent. And Edwards was still alive, and he was very gratified by this. It was 24 years before Edwards was finally vindicated as a truthful reporter in the case of the Cleveland operation. And it's interesting, you mentioned the tumor. When Keene was researching the article in 1917, he discovered that the tumor had been saved by one of the other doctors. And so he asked that the tumor be donated to a museum in Philadelphia. It's called the Mutter Museum. It's a museum of medical history. And to this day, you can go to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia and see the tumor that was removed from Grover Cleveland's mouth. I was just going to mention that, you know, for years it tantalized doctors what kind of cancer Grover had, because it was very unusual in the 1890s to have it, you know, be operated for the removal of a cancerous tumor and then survive 15 years. And it wasn't until the 1970s that the Cleveland Children finally allowed testing to be done on the tumor, and they discovered he had a very rare kind of malignant cancer. It's called varicose carcinoma, or VC, and it's technically malignant, but it doesn't metastasize, and it wasn't even identified until 1948. And so it turned out the doctors in 1893 thought they were dealing with a much more lethal form of cancer, but the procedure would have been just the same. A patient who has the kind of cancer that Grover had still gets the same treatment. All you can do is cut the tumor out.
There's a little bitty part of your book at the end where you're bringing us all the way into the 1940s or 50s. And I think it was it Eisenhower that was at a dinner?
What happened was that it's a funny story. Frances Cleveland, you know, we mentioned her, the youngest first lady in American history. Well, she lived a long time. She lived until the late 1940s. And she actually remarried after Grover died. She married a Princeton professor named Thomas Preston. And in 1947, she was at a fancy dinner in Washington, and she was seated next to Eisenhower, but her place card only identified her as Mrs. Thomas Preston, and Eisenhower had no idea who she was. And so they started talking about Washington, and at some point, Frances mentioned that she had once lived in Washington, and Eisenhower said, "Really? Where?" And that was only then that he discovered that he was talking to the former Mrs. Grover Cleveland.
In the White House. So Grover Cleveland leaves the presidency. People believe him. They really feel that he's done a good job as president, and that was all a lot of nonsense about that surgery and all that business. And he goes off to do what?
He actually retired. He was succeeded by McKinley. And retired to Princeton, New Jersey, where he served on the board of trustees at Princeton. And it was a really great experience for Grover. You know, Grover had never gone to college. He was completely self-educated. He studied law in a law office and passed the bar, but he really never had formal education after the age of 16. And so to him, the experience in Princeton, it was almost like the delayed college experience. He really enjoyed it. After football games, the students would all come to Grover's house, and he'd come out on the porch and lead them in cheers. And he really enjoyed his final days in Princeton. He fathered two more children in Princeton. He had a child at 71. And it's funny because the children lived a long time themselves. The last Cleveland child died in 1995.
Just out of curiosity, what did that Cleveland child end up doing with his life?
Cleveland had five children in all. You know, his first child was named Ruth, and she was famous as Baby Ruth. Some people say the candy bar is actually named after her. The second child, Esther, as I mentioned, she was born in the White House when he was president. And then he had three more children. One of his sons became a very prominent Democratic politician and lawyer in Baltimore. And the other one moved up to New Hampshire and became very active in local theater and started a local theater in Tamworth, New Hampshire, and did that really until the day he died.
You mentioned the fact, of course, that Grover Cleveland was a Democrat, but boy, there were aspects of his politics that sounds nothing like the Democratic politics of today.
No, it was very different back then. And, you know, actually, it's funny. Ron Paul keeps a picture of Grover Cleveland in his office.
That sums it all up.
Of where Grover Cleveland would stand on the spectrum today. I mean, I call him the last of the do-nothing presidents, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but he really saw his job primarily as being to keep Congress from passing bad laws. He vetoed more bills in his first term than all his predecessors combined. He was known as the veto president, and that's really what he saw. He saw his job as playing defense in the White House, to keep an eye on Congress and make sure they didn't do anything unconstitutional. And this really appeals to a lot of conservatives and libertarians today. A lot of conservative and libertarian groups put Grover Cleveland on their list of greatest presidents of all time.
Well, Matthew, we've run out of time, but boy, you've given our listeners a great insight into a fascinating period in American history, and we thank you so much for it. Again, the book is The President is a Sick Man. Matthew Algio, thank you for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Oh, you're welcome, Bob. It's my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Matthew Algio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.